we have two brains in our skull. One is a small one, is a very diligent, that I call the good enough brain. And then there is a larger one, which we can call the wiser one. And in fact, what I will conclude today is that we have only one brain, but it's a very wide continuum. It's a skewed distribution, and my talk will be about skewed distributions. So neuroscience is jealous of physics, typically, because physics can come up with beautiful laws. They can organize their life in a very complicated, but nevertheless simplified manner, whereas neuroscience doesn't have really many, many laws. But there is one that we all agree upon, and this is probably one of the most persuasive laws in neuroscience, which is the Weber law. Everybody in the room, I assume, knows Weber law. Is there anybody who doesn't? Okay, who does know? Is there anybody? Okay, tell them. What is the Weber law? Say it louder. So what it says that our perceptions change linearly when the stimulus changes logarithmically, okay? So if you, the typical example that we can use is that a very small amount of change in light intensity would be noticed by everybody if we were in a complete dark room. However, if it switch on the light, everybody with a bright light here, then we need the same percentage or approximately the same percentage of change, but it will be, of course, much bigger. So it's the ratio of change that matters rather than the absolute magnitude. So this is the Weber law, and you said this is a psychophysical law. It's true for every single sensation that we are aware of. But it's not only sensation, this a simple sensation. It is true also for the perception of time, short-term memory, perception of space, and so on. So we would like to know, of course, where this persuasive law comes from. And I don't have a good answer, but at least I have two suggestions. One is that there is a wide dynamic range in the dynamics of the brain, and I will show you that it applies to almost every single level that we can examine, and it is supported by a structure that follows the same kind of rule. Now, we know some log rules in the brain, which is the system of rhythms. There are many, many rhythms, many of you know, at least 10 of them, and they are lining on a natural logarithmic scale. But this is not the from here to go to psychophysics is a little bit difficult. On the other hand, when we would like to go from spiking neurons to psychophysics, there is probably hope. So before I go further on, I'd like to show you that there is a rule, which I call log normal rule, that is so effective, but before I can tell you, I have to explain you, or at least many of you, what is log normal distribution. Everybody knows what log normal distribution is. Log normal distribution is a distribution of measurements that show a bell-shaped curve. For example, your height, your brain size, your skull size, and so on. These are all normal distributions. Most of the things inside the brain, however, are skewed. So here's a skewed distribution that shows the firing rate of many, many neurons in the hippocampus. So you take a neuron, you record from the neuron for a minute, an hour, 5 hours, 10 hours, and then you get the mean firing rate. And then you ask every single neuron, what is your favorite firing rate? What is your mean firing rate? And you tabulate it, and you will find that there are pyramidal cells that are very, very reluctant to fire, and there are neurons that are very diligent because they fire a lot. And now when you look at the skew distribution and you put it on a log scale, you will find that it's a very beautiful normal, that is bell-shaped curve. So the log normal distribution is a logarithmic normal distribution. Now, why am I obsessed about this? Well, we know how to generate normal distributions, which is add or subtract random numbers. The same applies to the log normal distribution, where you have to multiply or divide random numbers. And division and multiplication is a ubiquitous rule in the nervous system. Just think about the action potential, which is the charge multiplied by time, and then you've got the action potential. Or the presynaptic neuron, postsynaptic neuron relationship is a log normal distribution. Is also a relationship, and it shows a multiplication. And then I will show you that it has a log normal rule also. So let's start the macroscopic picture of the brain, which is connectivity. So you can ask, by injecting a tracer in any part of the neocortex, what other structures are connected to this one? And this has been done for centuries and for a long time, but there were no rules. But once the Allen Institute started to inject many, many, many sites in the neocortex and subcortical stripes, then this is the rule that came up. Every part of the neocortex is connected very strongly to a handful of other structures. But the same area is connected to many, many, many more structures in a weak manner. And when you have all these connections quantified, then this is the picture that you get. It doesn't matter whether you are looking for ipsilateral connections, the contralateral connections, only cortical connections, or subcortical connections. The rule is always a log rule. So this is a log scale here, and this shows you the log normal distribution. So this is very interesting because it says that the strong connectivity occurs among the headful, and we can say the strong connections happen between 10% of the neurons, but the weak connections happens to the rest of the neurons. Now, these areas are connected by myelinated and non-myelinated fibers. So the traffic between the areas can be slow, fast, or anything in between. And the speed varies orders of magnitude, and the reason why they do, because when you look at the axon diameters, either in the optic nerve or in the corpus callosum or anywhere in the nervous system, in any mammalian species, it shows you a log normal distribution. Okay? So this was macroscopic connectivity through various fibers. Now let's look at the microscopic features of a single neuron. Pyramidal cells have spines. Spines are coming small and large sizes. And then when we tabulate the size distribution of the spines, then we will find it that their distribution is also log normal. So spine size have been known for a long time. It correlates very strongly with the efficacy of the synapse, which is also called synaptic weight. So people have measured synaptic weight distributions. And in fact, I remember from lectures from Sergio Nichols many years ago that he reported on funny synapses. They were 100 times stronger than the regular synapses that everybody have seen in the laboratory. These were spinal cord synapses. And then other people occasionally found something like this. But in order to have statistics, you need hundreds or thousands of these measurements. And when you have them, then you will find that, it doesn't matter whether you are looking at the mouse or rat or visual cortex or barrel cortex or wherever you want, the distribution is log normal. So most of the synapses are weak, and some of them are very strong. Now, in vivo, this is all in vitro. In vivo, measurements of synaptic weights is difficult. In fact, what is lacking from neuroscience is measurement and quantification of synaptic weights. But there is an indirect way of assessing synaptic connectivity, which I call spike transmission probability, which is that you measure the spike of a presynaptic neuron, and you look at the probability of the postsynaptic neurons to respond with a spike that you can also measure extracellularly, given the presynaptic spike. So here's an example. There is the pyramidal cell spike shown there, and then it's not very visible here with this dark picture, but about a millisecond or 2 milliseconds later, the density of the responding spikes are very high, as shown by these cross-correlograms here at a short 1 or 2 millisecond time scale, and the width of the response is also within the monosynaptic length. And you can see from the ordinates here that this one and this one is 10 times different. So when you make all these measurements, then you will find that in vivo, spike transmission probability also shows a skewed log normal rule. Now, this log normality is present during running, REM sleep, immobility, slow wave sleep. The shapes are very similar, except the population activity, the mean, moves a little bit. Spike transmission probability in the neocortex and in many synapses and in the hippocampus is strongest in the waking state and weakest during slow wave sleep. Nevertheless, the shape is the same. So I have to take you through a boring laundry list first before I tell you why this is an interesting thing. So the laundry is, follows in every single station in the hippocampus, CA3, CA1, granule cells, layer 2, layer 3, layer 5 of the entorhinal cortex. And what you can see there, it doesn't matter which structure you're looking at, they all follow the same exact rule, and they are relatively similar but shifted between the different states. So this is interesting because those of you who know about the hippocampus, and we discussed it before, we all know that a map that the hippocampus generates is different in every single environment. This is called remapping or orthogonalization of the utility or utilization of the structure. So you take a pyramidal cell or 100 pyramidal cells in the hippocampus, you look at their spatial correlates in one environment, you take them in another environment, and the observation typically is that those neurons have only a random relationship with the same neurons in another room. This is orthogonalized. So if that is the case, then there should be independence of the firing grade distribution in different rooms. So here's an example. The same neuron is tested when the animal is going in one way or the animal is running back on a linear track. And it has been known for a long time that the sequences of the neurons and the neurons that are being active in one direction are totally different from the neurons that are representing the return path. Or if you take this, the same animal from this track and put it in a square environment in a different room, you have a very different distribution, such as this one here. For example, this neuron likes to fire in one direction, it doesn't fire in the other direction at all. This neuron doesn't fire on the linear track, it seems at all, and then it fires in the square room, and then you can see various variations. Now, in the linear track, you can look at the maximum firing rate, that the peak firing rate of the neuron, somewhere along the track, and then taking the left direction or the right direction, you can look at these, and you can see these beautiful sequences are very different when the animal is going left or right. However, this is an optical illusion. Optical illusion by mean that we play with the colors, and we play with the colors on a linear scale. If you look at any of the neurons with the red there, of course it fires elsewhere as well. So it doesn't mean that the neurons are silent. And this is just the linear scale. So now let's look at the relationship on a log scale. And here comes the surprise. What we are looking at here is that the relationship of the firing rates, not where the neurons fire, but the firing rates, how many spikes the neuron fired in one environment, which is the square, or in the other environment, which is the linear track. And what you see here is there is a relationship. In fact, it's a reliable, statistically reliable relationship. And if we go from to another area, CA3, is this is just one session. Now we go on many, many sessions, and then this is the picture you get. An extraordinary stubborn relationship. Those neurons that like to talk, they like to talk all the time in every single environment. And there are the modest ones that they don't want to say much in any environment, or they say only when they have something to say, and they do it in every single environment. So neurons also fire burst, not only single spike, but burst. And it turns out that the same thing occurs. If a neuron fires or likes to fire burst in one environment, it likes to fire burst in another environment, and also in different states. And we can even go further. So, well, what is the relationship between the firing rates of neurons in a well-learned environment? I have been in this room several times, so this environment is not novel to me anymore. But my neurons that are active here will be active when I go to Alan's presidential office or in any new room in Collège de France that I haven't been to. And this is the case also for the rat. So here you can see that the firing rates of individual neurons in a familiar environment are correlated with the same neurons firing in a totally new environment. Moreover, you can record from an animal's environment in the home cage, or from an animal's brain in the home cage, and then you can put the animal in a completely new environment, and you can tell in advance that those neurons that were diligently firing during sleep in the home cage will be firing in a novel environment. And you can put the animal back in the home cage, and they will be firing again. So this is the relationship here. So for many years, people asked about what is the relationship between firing patterns and the individual properties of the neurons and their the way how they fire in different environments. And most of my examples will be from the hippocampus, you have to forgive me, but many of them are related also or can be generalized to the neocortex. So we can ask in V1, for example, how many orientations a neuron will fire? And then everybody knows that orientation selectivity is a good feature for neurons. Most neurons respond only to one feature. But investigators have occasionally described that they respond to two, three, four, and people have debated whether these are not really one neuron, whether they are two neurons, and so on. Because they don't have enough, they cannot do this good statistics. But in the hippocampus, we could, and for about 20 years of debate has been short-circuited by having many neurons and showing a distribution. Most neurons don't fire at all. The majority of them have only one place field. But some of them have more than five, very few of them. And it shows a log, a beautiful log distribution that is very effective here. So you can ask a similar question, is that if an animal is firing, if an animal is running in a radial arm maze and the neuron fires in one arm, what is the probability that it will fire in another arm? And there is a probability, and you can see that's the probability distribution. It shows very, very similar distribution, the number of place fields. And another investigator at the Albert Lee in Janelia Farms, he asked a different question. How far the animal should run that every single neuron in the hippocampus will be active at least once? And the second question he asked, whether these neurons are coming out from after each other in a lawfully manner, or if it's an unknown territory the animal has to run through, what are the drawing rules? And the drawing rules are this. There are neurons, and in fact the majority of them, that fire only in one part of the environment, even though this track is 50 meters long. It's a very, very long track. The animal has to go through a very long corridor in the Howard Hughes Institute. But there are some other neurons that, you know, this is also 50 meters, that fire many, many, many places. And then you can look at the distribution, and the distribution is very similar to what I've just shown you. Now we can go one step further, in fact, back to the original idea that there is such a thing as orthogonalization. So the Moser group tried to investigate it by saying, if a neuron fires in one environment, what is the probability that it should fire in another environment and whether this is different from chance? And to their surprise and happiness, they find that when the animal is being tested in 11 rooms, that they find a lawful distribution. Most of them, 85% of them, fire only in a single environment. As you can see in N3, this neuron fires and virtually nowhere else. And there is another neuron that likes to fire in multiple places, and those neurons that like to fire in multiple rooms, in fact, sometimes they fire even in the same position. So what is the distribution? Is the exceptions are exceptions, or they were not really one neurons, but they were lumped together from two or three clusters? No, the answer is very clear. It shows a beautiful skewed distribution as well. It's just another way of showing it. Further, there are certain features that are connected to the firing rate of the neuron. So those neurons, they like to talk a lot, have larger place fields, as shown up down here, and more place fields. So it's not only that the log rule relates only to one feature, but it is referring to multiple features. In other words, a single measure, such as the firing rate of the neuron, leads to a lot of consequences because the firing rate of each neuron can be conceived as the fingerprint of that neuron. So the interesting thing, of course, here is that if all of these are related to each other, you can say, what is the meaning, what is the utility of the fact that you put the animal into the new environment, into the different environment. In one case, you will have, some neurons will say, I'm in a different room, and this is the majority rule. Everybody says, I'm in a different room. But some neurons tend to say, no, you are in the same room, you are the same room, because they generalize across the different environments. And if it applies, if that the cartoon way, can say that the weak synapses always say that we are different. Everything is different, but the strong synapses say that there is not so much difference between the two situations. It's pretty much the same. Now, this is a very important take-home message, is that those ideas that we tend to use to describe the world as similar and different are very difficult categories, because similar is different. Similar is also identical, but it shows that probably this is just the end of the same distribution. There is nothing new for the brain. There's absolutely nothing new in the brain. I can show you anything and you would say, aha, it is like. You have never seen a new room. There is no new river. There is no new mountain. There is no new discovery. There is nothing absolutely, completely novel. So the important thing is that the brain is not only say that there is a redirection, there is a redistribution, there is an orthogonalized representation of something. Every single time, the representation of the normal contains the elements of familiarity. And the familiarity, novelty gradient is a distribution. It just shows that we call the two ends of the distribution by different names. We can go further on and say, okay, if these are the features and they are distinct, these neurons are distinct from each other, then what are their further features? So this is a nice example from Thomas Klausberger experiment. They did the following thing. They backfired neurons in the ventral hippocampus from different structures. These neurons like to project to the accumbens, the prefrontal cortex, or the amygdala. And a subset of them project to three cases, or three targets. And they didn't ask, but I discovered it in their papers, that those neurons, they have three targets. They have got three times longer axons, probably. It is also expressed by their tripled firing rates. So it seems that the activity of the neuron is very strongly related to other features. For example, people have shown in slices that if a neuron is fast firing, and if there is another neuron that is fast firing, their connectivity is much higher. The probability of being connected is much higher. In other words, the talkative neurons are better connected to each other, and they are better connected to everybody else. They form what people call a rich club. They get information, and they are the ones that they make decisions. Now, this was all about the hippocampus, but I'm just illustrating to you that this is the same case in the neocortex. Whether you are looking at monkey, whether you're looking at the human, whether you are looking at neurons in the ventral horn of the spinal cord, everywhere. And, of course, the same idea occurs in the neocortex, that the neurons that like to fire high spontaneously are the ones that always respond stronger to any situation. Again, the analogy in humans would be that those people who like to talk under one condition, they are always talking and interrupting conversation as others all the time. And it is the other set of neurons from two different parts of the brain. They are all head direction systems, head direction neurons, and they show the same thing. Now, I talked about the connectivity first, macroscopic, mesoscopic, and microscopic connectivity. Then I talked about the firing dynamics of the neurons, spikes, burst, and the co-activity of the ones. And now we would like to know, what is the distribution of the magnitude of the responses, or the magnitude of spontaneous co-firing or population firing? In other words, what is the probability that neurons fire together in any given time window? It has to have a distribution as well. At the present time, in your hippocampi, about 0.6% of the neurons fire in a duration of about 100 milliseconds together. That is very, very few. But this is a fake number because it gives you a mean. A mean, of course, is meaningless in a distribution which is skewed, because the mean characterizes only normal distribution. We can use median, but the best thing is to describe the entire distribution. So here, what you can ask is that when there is a pattern, hippocampal sharp wave ripples that we discussed at least once or twice during the previous talk, you can ask, If you recruit from 100 neurons, or 75 in this case, what fraction of these neurons fire together during the sharp phase? And then you say, sometimes it's only 10%, sometimes 20%, sometimes it's 0, 0, 0, and so on. And then you look at the distribution, and then you will find that it's a very beautiful log-normal distribution. The champion can fire almost half of the time, neurons that like to participate. But also the largest fraction of neurons firing together every now and then is 35% or so. Otherwise, it would be an interictal discharge. Most of the time, very few neurons fire together. But now you can take the same address the same question and say, oh, this is about a 50 millisecond time window. What if you look at the 50 second time window another time, such as when the animal is running or solving a task? And the answer is the same exact rule occurs. It's a log-normal distribution. Most of the time, very few neurons fire together, but occasionally a lot higher, sometimes in order of two orders of magnitude there. So far, I hope I arouse your curiosity about the firing rate distribution, because it's an important matter. But you can say, well, it's an interesting thing, but how does it connect to anything interesting that we are all interested about? So the answer is that the brain has to deal with all this complicated stuff, which is competing in two different directions. We would like to stabilize the brain. We would like to make it resilient. We would like to make it stubborn, but at the same time, we would like to make it plastic. The brain has to learn about novelty, but the brain also has to remember about what is not so novel. And the answer is that these competing requirements are typically met in nature when the answer is diversity. The elements, diverse elements, are bound together. They have these features that they are both robust, they are both resilient, but at the same time are responding very effectively to environmental perturbations. Now, let me reiterate what I had said so far. Firing rates and other features of the neurons are very diverse and they show two or three orders of magnitude difference. I'm talking about the very same type of neuron. I'm not lumping together fast-firing interneurons and pyramidal cells. I'm saying that the log-normal rule occurs in a layer 5 pyramidal cell, in a CA1 pyramidal cell, which we classify as one type. But if it comes to interneurons, such as a fast-firing basket cell, that also shows global distribution. There are basket cells that fire only 5 hertz, and there are basket cells that fire about 80 hertz for the entire period of our life, forever. So the other thing that already was apparent to you, I hope, is that it's not the situation that a small percentage of neurons are firing now, and tomorrow another small percentage will be firing, or tonight a small percentage of neurons will be firing, and the statistical distribution are the same, but the members of the distribution change. The members remain put. It's always the small percentage of neurons that are diligently active, whereas the most of them remain inactive for a long period of time. So here are the questions that you would like to know. How are these distributions brought about if they are interesting? Unfortunately, we don't know much about that. My hunch is that the fast neurons, the best connected ones, those are that are connected to each other very well, and they are connected to many other structures, are the first-born neurons. And later on, the neurons that are coming on a little bit later, half a day later, 2 days later, and so on, are the ones that are slow firing. I have no proof for whatsoever. I have a graduate student who is examining this question. The second one does, how stable are these distributions? As I said, they are stable over a couple of hours, a couple of days, perhaps, and I made a bold claim that they are the fingerprints, therefore they have to stay there forever. How will they maintain? And, of course, how nature or the brain exploits them for doing something useful. So how long are they stable? We don't have very long recordings, but this is the champion from Charles Lieber from Harvard. He's using a funny technology he calls injectable structures. These are like microsponges that they are going very, very, very close to the neurons, makes a lot of damage, but those surviving neurons that are being recorded, they can be recorded forever, basically. And these are several weeks, and you can see 3 neurons up there, their firing rates remain exactly the same for many, many, many days. Even more exciting is to think what happens if you perturb this firing relationship, such as an experiment from Gina Turigiano's lab. So it's a much shorter one. They are recording over just a few days. But nevertheless, when they suture one of the eyes, we know that there is a rearrangement in the visual system. There is a transient change lasting for about 1 or 2 days that the firing rates are perturbed, but then it comes back to its original rate. So even though there is no input, so to speak, at least no external input from the retina to these neurons through the lateral geniculate, they come back to their own preferred firing rate state, as if it's internally determined. Every neuron knows, every neuron calibrates its output and said, I want to get back to my set level. So if that is the case, they probably have some other features that are related to it. And the other feature of each neuron that we know about is the interspike interval variability. Neurons rarely fire rhythmically perfectly. Most of them are firing arrhythmically. We say they show a Poisson-like distribution. And then the issue is that how does this Poisson-like distribution of firing rates relate to the firing rate of the neuron itself? And the answer is lawfully. So here you can see many neurons from the cortex, pyramidal cell, the interneurons, from the CA1 region of the hippocampus. And they are sorted by firing rate. And what is shown here is the interspike interval distributions here. And you can see that there is a nice relationship. The message of this figure is that every neuron, every pyramidal cell can fire when they are tickled the right way to about 80 hertz. 80, 90 hertz is the maximum firing rate, but it doesn't matter whether the background activity is slow or fast, even though related, but they can fire at this very fast rate. However, when you look at the other side, there is a lot of silence there. It means that those neurons that fire fast, they cannot do one thing. They cannot remain silent for a long period of time. The reason why slow-firing neurons are slow-firing because they manage to stay silent for a longer period of time. So what is difficult for the neuron is not to spike, but to remain silent. And this is a picture of the interspike interval distribution, and this is a tricky one because it asks, you know, what is the relationship between, here's the spike, and here's the spike before, and here's the spike after. If the interval was this, how does it relate to the next one? And it shows some pattern, and you can see that the pattern's changing quite a lot across these neurons, and underneath each of these, you can see the firing rate. And you can see that as the firing rate changes, the pattern changes. So it's not only the firing rate, but that's the easiest thing to measure, but the pattern of the firing of the neuron in the isolation is also very tightly connected to the rate. So the next question we would like to summarize here, that indeed, the firing rate distributions are related to many other features of the neuron. The next one we would like to know is how you maintain these firing rates forever, because we have to maintain. Again, we don't know, but one answer is that probably sleep does something like this. It has been promoted for a long time that the sleep has a homeostatic role, something that Claude Bernard introduced, although he didn't care much about the brain or didn't study the brain. But also the sleep is there for us because we would like to recover things that have been destroyed or used during the waking state. And Giulio Tudoni and Alex Borbé, they came up with this homeostatic idea is that during the waking hours, we use up lots of ATP and the neurons get exhausted. They fire a lot and during sleep, the firing rate comes back. Because at the beginning and the end of sleep, especially non-REM sleep, the firing rate continuously change. Now, here is the problem. The problem is when you assume that the firing rate distributions are normal rather than log normal, then what you do is you take an average. But an average is always dominated by the fast-firing neurons. And that's a mistake. So indeed, what you can see on the top here is that here there is a fast-firing neuron, right? And the fast-firing neuron is active, during waking, and then it's firing, it comes down when the animal falls asleep, and it comes back when the animal is active again, and so on. So then the conclusion for the phosphoric neurons is true. But now we can do the trick. It said, okay, what we would like to know is to separate the neurons into categories, let's say six sextiles, and see how those neurons that are firing at slow or firing fast behave. And the answer is those neurons that are very slow firing or hardly ever spike during the waking state, in fact, they become more active during sleep. So it's not that there is an overall downgrading of the firing rates, but in fact, it's in a tricky way. The fast ones got slower, and the slow ones got faster. And this is shown here for the entire group. This is over 1,000 neurons, and this is the message. The message is that what happens during sleep is not that you shift the firing rates from fast to slow, but you have the log distribution, and those that fired fast, they become a little slower, and those that fired very slow, they become a little bit faster. So the shape of the curve changes, and everything is tend to coming to the middle rather than the left. So how does it happen? And what is the rule, how it can do? Well, we already know about a couple of plasticity rules, and one of them is spike timing dependent plasticity. So we can ask, what is the relationship, for example, when during non-REM sleep, which is characterized by up and down states, shown here, this is an intercellular recording, but it would be very closely to the so-called slow oscillations here, which is shown here in the LFP. And the firing probability of different neurons, especially the slow and fast neurons. So on the bottom left here, what we show is that in the color scale is that neurons, they like to fire first, which is on the left, are the ones that are high-firing neurons. And those neurons that are reluctant to fire spontaneously, they are recruited much later in the upstate. And if we compare the first part and the second part of the sleep, we will see that it's not a random, but it's a lawfully thing that happens statistically reliable manner, that the first neurons are the ones that start the activity. Now, we can show it a different way, is that what is the relationship between the first part, the second part, and the firing rate of the neurons. And you can see that most of the red is here and so on. Now, when we'd like to correlate all the neurons with each other, we find something interesting. If it was just a simple Poisson distribution, it's not surprising that the fast-firing neurons, two fast-firing neurons, happen to fire together. And those neurons that are very reluctant, they fire slow, they hardly ever fire together. And this is shown in the upper right and lower left corner. But the surprising thing is that those neurons that are fast firing and slow firing, that is those pairs, they have a negative correlation. Those neurons, that pairs, that is, one is a very talkative, the other one is very silent, they hardly ever fire together. In fact, they avoid each other. Why is that? The answer is very simple. Because of this recruitment rule. These neurons hardly ever fire together with the fast ones. This is designed, or by design, of the up and down states and the firing rate rule within the upstate. So the consequence of this, of course, is something like this, namely, that there is a fast firing neuron always fires before the slow firing neurons. So the fast firing neurons, that or the middle ones, is trying to change this according to spike time independent plasticity in such a way that the fast firing neurons actually decrease their firing rates. And the ones that are very reluctant to fire, they are helped by the middle, but the faster ones, and their activity is in fact increased. So a very simple plasticity rules combined with the behavior of the neurons during the up and down states gives you the rule or gives you the lawful change that happens during slow-wave sleep in such a way that the fast-firing neurons become less active, whereas the slow neurons become more active. I can skip this one, but it happens also, this is the case in the hippocampus. Now, let's see some interesting functions for this skew distribution that should come out by this. Every single time nature experiences something lawfully recurring events, it's trying to exploit it. So one of the things that we would like to know is that what are the rules regarding plasticity and the rigidity and degeneracy and so on for those neurons that are in one end of the log distribution or the other end of the distribution. So one of the ways how we measure or examine plasticity in vivo is to have a control and use another control, and then we do some manipulations. So this is a typical scenario. We record patterns during sleep, followed by a novel or not so novel learning situation, and followed by another sleep period. And we assume that the difference between the two sleep periods reflects what happened during the learning period. Now, this works very well, and many, many reports have been shown here, showing that this sequence, for example, place cell sequences, are replayed during sharp wave ripples following learning. And this is fundamentally and absolutely different from what happened before, but not quite. In this cartoon, you can see that the sequence is pretty much the same before. And in fact, what we would like to show is that what is the relationship between sleep before and sleep after, and what is the relationship between two sleep periods. Now, remember that in one of my first slides, I already show you very convincing evidence that the firing rates and the bursts and everything, they are stayed in put. They are not changing. So what is their correlation structure that we expect to change? The answer is that very large part of this dynamic is very strongly internally organized. There is a tsunami effect of stability, and what will happen with this new learning situation is that a tiny little thing is riding on these tsunami waves. Most of the dynamic in the brain is already there from the beginning. So how do we test these ideas, and how do we show convincingly that there was a change between pre-sleep and post-sleep? What is very fashionable today is that what we do is we take a population vector, a population analysis, and then we use a various population approaches such as the Bayesian prediction, and you can say, what is the probability given this distribution of the neuron, and we find this distribution as our template, and then we can take a template during sleep, typically during the sharp wave ripples, and said, oh, I observed that these neurons fire a sequence. From here, I'd like to predict where the animal would be on the track given the sequence. So we take the priors from sleep, and then we predict from that prior where the animal would be in the track. Now, this is very good, except we already know that in a population analysis, a small minority can play a very important role. So if you have 100 neurons, maybe only 2 or 3 neurons actually matter. The rest of them doesn't matter. In order to show how much do matter, you have to characterize every single neuron. And the way to do that is that you make your prediction, and then you take one out. And then you take the other one out. And then every single time you take one out, you recalculate the whole thing. And the difference between the original and the one without will be the contribution of that one neuron. So if there are 3 neurons that carry all the information, if you take all those 3 neurons away, then the rest of the population cannot predict anything. So we can characterize every single neuron. Now, when you do that, then you can ask us that, when you have this beautiful sequence, which ones were there in the first place? And which ones were added as a result of experience? And you can do it by looking at the correlation, the magnitude of the correlation before sleep and after sleep. And those that have very high correlation before sleep and after sleep are shown here in gray. And the ones that are changed, they were protruding into this, that come as a result of the true experience, are shown in red. So what you can see here is that there is already a skeleton, a prepared sequence that was there before the animal was put in a novel environment. And it turns out that if you separate the two populations, that the rigid, that is the skeleton, is the population of the fast-firing neurons as shown on the right. And the ones that are willing to change, they are, we can call them the plastic category, they are the ones that are slow firing. Now, if you can go one place further and you go back now to the learning situation and you do a trial by trial analysis, and what they can say, what is the difference between the fast and the slow? And the answer is, the ones that are fast, they are the rigid, they also have place fields from trial one, but they don't change it. They don't change in a way that our measure here is that what is the ratio of the firing rate of the neurons inside the field and outside the field. You can call it a signal-to-noise ratio. For those neurons that are plastic, the signal-to-noise ratio increases over trials. That is, they become crisper and carry higher information than before. Now, this was done in a Bayesian approach, but you can do it in a simple way. And every single time people give you information about anything in a highly complicated, non-transparent analysis manner, you are entitled to demand to have a simple analysis that gives you the same result. If not, you are entitled to remain skeptic. So here's an example. You can ask is that, what is the relationship between the firing rates as well as the sequences of the neurons in any of these situations? So one template you can take is the running session. During the running session, you can look at the firing rate distribution of the neurons here, and then every single thing that happens afterwards, this is the entire session mean in this case. So you lump everything together from 18 hours of recording, and then you can ask, what was the firing rate of the distribution of the neurons here, and in one situation during learning, and you will see that even by eye, it's clear that they correlate with each other very well. Now, you can do the same thing here. I said, this was just the rate, but what is the relationship of neurons, the correlations in any time window, typically about 100 millisecond window, and then you can see a two-dimensional map here during pre-sleep, pre-learning sleep. And you can see that the pattern changes a little bit from pre-sleep to post-sleep. Now the low-firing neurons show a little bit relatively higher correlation. And then the difference between the two gives you the answer is that it is the correlation of the low-firing rate neurons that increased as a function of learning. The high-firing rate neurons, they had high correlations from the beginning, but that high correlation remained the same. It didn't change. And this is shown here that, in fact, the low-firing rate cells are the ones that are changing plastically. It just happens that those neurons that are willing to change are the ones that they change their membership also with the Scharpe-Weil ripple. That is, those neurons that were slow firing, now they got a ticket to become members of the club. And they entered the Scharpe-Weil burst, and with the participation in the Scharpe-Weil burst became higher as a result of learning. Tiny, teeny. You can see that the effect is very, very small. The relative change is large, but the thing is small. So, how does it relate to that we claim that this is a plastic process? Now, we would like to be more analytical and say, well, what are the plastic rules that people do in the laboratory? Well, spike time dependent plasticity was another one, but another term, I don't know how many people among the young generation heard about this word, long-term potentiation. This is things of the past. 10 years ago, nothing existed in neuroscience, just long-term potentiation. It's a drastic change. What you do is use a 200 hertz or 100 hertz stimulus for 1 second long or 2 second long. Dramatically, you change the synaptic weights. So we wanted to see what is the relationship between these natural phenomena, such as changing place fields and so on, and this laboratory artifact. So the way we did that is we said, well, we ask, how can we make place fields, new place fields? And how can we make existing place fields disappear? And the argument is this. The reason why a CA1 pyramidal cell is a place cell is because it gets a constellation of inputs from different, many, many CA3 pyramidal cells that are representing position A, B, C, D. But it happens that from C, the input is strongest. Therefore, whenever the animal is in C, then this group of neurons are discharging the postsynaptic CA1 neurons. So if this is the case, then what if we scramble the synaptic weights? We change the synaptic weights between the upstream and downstream neurons artificially by this long-term potentiation paradigm. And this is what you can see here, is that this neuron had a place field here. We used long-term potentiation, LTP paradigm, and then we made a new place field. Interestingly, this place field was expressed only when the animal went to counterclockwise and not clockwise. So it shows that every neuron is embedded in a different assemblies or population of assemblies depending on the context. And we changed the rule only for one context. Now, this is old, but the interesting thing that we would like to revisit is this. Then we ask, can we change at will any place fields? And the answer is not. Those place fields that are very good and they are characterized with a high firing rate, high peak firing rate, and high infield firing rates are not going to be changeable by long-term potentiation. But the ones that are low-firing ones, which is the left end here, are the ones that they can show a large change. You can either make the place field disappear or you can make a new place field. So, indeed, the plasticity and rigidity can be brought back to the same fundamental rule, which is the firing rate, the baseline firing rate at that neuron. So now I'd like to show you something super bizarre. The super bizarre thing is this. We already mentioned that there are population activities, they change in according to the log-normal rule, and there are neurons that like to participate in sharp wave ripples. And these are the typically high firing rate neurons, but there are low firing neurons and so on. So we also know that by local optogenetic stimulation, we can generate an artificial ripple. So we can go back to the thinking and said, why is that this neuron fires fast here and this one doesn't during the sharp wave ripples? And the old answer is that because it was driven by an upstream neuron, the CA3 region, for example, and every single time there's a sharp wave ripple, that the CA3 region is driving it. Now, when we optogenetically activate neurons, then we can say, the expression of the opsin is very uneven across neurons. The light is scattered. It doesn't really go to all the neurons. So it's an odd situation, because what we would like to ask now is, what is the relationship between the firing rate of a neuron in a natural ripple and in an optogenetically generated ripple? By all logic, there should be no relationship. But the experiment refused the logic. So this is just shows that the probability of being partners in the sharp wave ripple depends on the baseline firing rate of the neuron. So if you measure the firing rate of a neuron over 5 hours, that's the baseline during sleep, for example, and then we look related to the firing rates of firing probability in the sharp wave ripple, they correlate. You believe it because I already showed you again. Now, we can also look at the baseline firing rate and the induced ripples. That's already surprising also, that they are very strongly correlated. The real thing here, the meat is, that what is the relationship between the firing probability of the neurons during the natural and the spontaneous ones? And the correlation there is staggering 0.46. It's a super, super strong. So how is it possible that in a system or in the circuit, which is the CA1 region, which has so few recurrent collaterals, you can have a distribution of the firing rates, which is very similar? And the answer is that this is a rigid circuit. Most circuits in the brain are already pre-configured. They are there because they maintain the brain's dynamic. You don't have to make it. Experience doesn't change the dynamic. Experience can add a tiny, tiny thing. But the brain is generated from the beginning to have all the dynamical rules that is being expressed in an adult brain. Now, this is only about firing rates? What about sequential correlations or something like this? So, and what about the relationships that we discussed before? So now this shows another experiment where the goal was to prolong ripples to make things a little bit better, especially in learning. And now we are not asking what is the relationship between the firing participation in the spontaneous ripples and in an artificially induced one, but what is the relationship when you between the firing participation of neurons when you prolong a ripple? So it's a closed-loop experiment. The ripple is going on, and you add another 100 milliseconds to the ripple. So it will be a longer one. And the answer is here that the spontaneous and the prolonged are related, but the interesting part is that the first part of the ripple is where the neurons that have a higher firing rates are participating. And in the second part of the ripple, which is the end of the ripple, the neurons that are being recruited spontaneously or by optogenetically are always the slow ones. If you still remember, this was exactly the same rule during the up and down states in the neocortex. So whatever rule occurred in the neocortex, that applies also to the hippocampus, even though this up and down state, the up state in the hippocampus is just the sharp wave. It's very short, but the rule is the same. Now, we can visit another area, for example, a visual cortex, and then it shows you a similar thing. Namely, those neurons, or let me repeat, that those that are fast-firing neurons are part of a rich club, they are better connected and so on. And this is an experiment which was a heroic experiment because each neuron was characterized according to in vivo features, and the bottom line is that if the in vivo features were similar, then after cutting the brain into slices and looking at the connectivity, those neurons that represented similar features had a better connectivity. Of course, in this experiment, you don't know whether this was made by some experience or it was there from the very beginning, or the other way around. Because it was there from the very beginning, this is why it represents a similar thing. So let me just summarize so far that the Lochnomer rule, at least regarding the firing rate, suggests that only a small fraction of our neurons are responsible for 50% of the computation all the time. This is what you can call a good enough computation, because it's there for you all the time, and it says familiar, novel, and makes fast judgment. But in order to be a little bit better, then you know it's not enough to be 50 or 80% okay when you're driving on the highway. You want to be 100%. And for being 100% accurate 100% of the time requires a very large volume of neurons. They have to work together. And it's also very important that how they are regulated, and I showed you some examples that probably non-REM sleep is the one that is responsible for this. So where does this lead us? So some people, some groups, already thought about this a little bit. It happens that these were my students. Ken Harris did a nice experiment in the auditory cortex, and what he did is he explored the spontaneous patterns. So he said spontaneous activity can visit this n-dimensional space billions of times, and this is the territory. Now let's look how this relate to the evoked ones that the animal experienced or could be experiencing anytime in its lifetime. And that's a much smaller area. In other words, there is an enormous reserve outside there. Another person, George Dragoi with Susumu Tonegawa, came to a similar conclusion. He called this, for short, preplay. He showed very similar things what we described, namely that looking at the animals during sleep, looking at the sequences during sharp wave ripples of sleep, can predict with better than chance probability what will be the sequential activity of the neurons in a completely novel environment. And then, of course, he showed that this is small relative to the post-sleep, where it is increasing, because indeed, sleep can add something, or learning can add something, but already to the already existed knowledge base. The knowledge base is enormous. And what is the knowledge base, of course, is also phylogenetic knowledge base, the way how the brain is constructed without any experience. So we can illustrate it with something like this, that there are already many, many pre-configured or pre-existing patterns or sequences, if you want, that are there. We just have to give, associate them with meaning. And learning doesn't do anything or much. Occasionally, this does something like this, that with the help of inhibitory neurons, with the help of inhibition, you can concatenate one of these relatively independent patterns, so you can get shortcuts to go from one pattern to the other pattern. But the patterns exist, and the richness of the patterns doesn't tell you very much. The hippocampus, for example, can already generate enormous number of patterns without any learning. Everybody in this room have pretty much the same number of sharp waves. It doesn't scale with experience, independent of age and so on. But the meaning of the pattern is not in the sender. The meaning of the pattern is always in the readout. And the meaning of that readout is there depending on whether that pattern has been matched already to experience through learning. So learning is a matching process between a pre-existing pattern and doing something. You can also say that the brain is a pre-existing dictionary full with a lot of nonsense words. But those nonsense words can become meaningful when we can ground them to something else through experience. And this brings us back to the first lecture I was talking about. Now, to summarize what we have said so far, indeed, that we have two extreme patterns in the brain. One is the good enough brain that is there and that can act fast and do a lot of interesting things. But it's not good enough because in some conditions you need very high precision. In this phase, you have to include the many low-firing neurons that are there waiting for being employed. And the plastic rules are also very different. And probably the most important message of this talk today was that those discrete words that we like to use, such as familiar and novel, are not antagonistic to each other. In fact, one assumes the other, and the reason for that is because in the brain there is a continuum and there is everything in between novel and familiarity. So thank you very much.